How did it all go so wrong? Why did it have to end this way? Last week, we heard how Jesus read from the scriptures in the synagogue, and all the people were amazed by him. Joseph's son made good. But then it all went pear-shaped. Jesus went on to preach, and before long, those same people were all of them, filled with rage. They drove him out of town so that they could hurl him off a cliff. How did it all go so wrong? If Jesus had a PR department, they would have been tearing their hair out. You had them eating out of the palm of your hand. You were doing so well. Then you went and ruined it. It's a marketing nightmare. Spin doctors would have been scrambling for a headline that might turn the story round. I don't know. Jesus having an off day. Jesus overawed by being in front of chrome crowd. Go for the sympathy vote. There was none of that. Instead, Jesus went calmly on his way through the angry crowd and entered the city of Capernaum. There, again, he went into a synagogue. There, again, the people were astonished at his teaching. And this time, Jesus healed a man who was demon-possessed, and the good news of Jesus spread throughout the region. Two halves of the story, two synagogues, two sermons, one healing. Why? Was it something he said? Of course it was. To us, the two stories that Jesus highlights when he is in Nazareth, the one from the life of Elijah and the one from his successor Elisha, may not seem such a big deal. But these folk knew their scriptures. Neither Elijah or Elisha were known for hometown healing. The widow that Elijah healed was not Jewish. And Elisha healed the leader of an enemy army. Jesus is pointing out that when the great prophets were active, it wasn't Israel who benefited, but the people of other tribes and nations. Israel's God was always rescuing the wrong people. And Jesus is saying he intends to follow suit. He will not be a prophet who serves the special interests of his hometown, but rather he is a messenger of good news for the whole world, especially those who are most vulnerable. It's as if he's saying, when I talk about God coming to free the oppressed and bless the poor, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about God blessing the people you can't stand, the people you don't want to be near you, the people you think of as enemies. Difficult words to hear, but they were the words they most needed to hear. Yet the crowd think, what? God favors Syria and not Israel. God heal in Capernaum and not Nazareth. I don't think so. We are the special ones. They are enraged. Jesus goes and does the one thing you're never supposed to do, even to strangers, let alone friends and neighbors. He tells them the truth about themselves, about their pettiness and prejudice, the desire to get ahead, even at the expense of others. The truth about their sense of privilege and entitlement, that they were more deserving than others. He's challenging the toxic and corrosive effect of a sense of privilege. Today it could be wealth privilege, gender privilege, straight privilege, birth privilege, you name it. He tells them about the truth about themselves, and so they want him gone. They want him silenced. Do you think things have changed much? Do you think Jesus' sermon about the priority, about the primary focus being to help the poor and the oppressed, would go over any better today? Thousands slept outside last night on the coldest night of the year to date. Doesn't seem to be a priority. It's not making the headlines. Thousands have been pushed below the breadline by the introduction of universal credit. It just doesn't seem important in a nation tied up in knots about Brexit and borders and backstops. Borders have been a part of my entire life. One border in particular, 10 miles from where I grew up, there is talk of building walls again, 20 years after they were torn down. Anxiety is rising. I felt a stab of recognition this week when I read Dee McDonald's words. One of my earliest childhood memories is of a circling red light motioning cars to stop near the border, silencing all who encountered its fiery glare. That red light filled my young heart with fear. I didn't know if the gloved hand holding the torch was that of the police, the British Army, the IRA or the UVF. The threat of the border coming back. It's not about the economy. It's not about the money. The reality is that no amount of economic modelling can capture the unquantifiable human and psychological costs of a return to a hard border. End quote. The truth is that borders can do great damage to the people on either side, just as much damage to those who are being kept in as those who are being kept out. My mother worked as an English teacher at the secondary school I went to. As a teenager, there is nothing quite like having your friends being taught English literature by your mother. And one of her favourite poems, that favourite of curriculums for decades, was Robert Frost's poem, Mending Wall. It's ironic that the most well-known line is, good fences make good neighbours, when the whole point of the whole poem is the exact opposite. For the poet names a truth that runs before the poet all the way back to Jesus' day and from him up to our own heated debates about borders. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offence. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I think Jesus would agree with the poet. For the challenging thing about the God we know in Jesus is that whenever you and I draw a line between who's in and who's out, we'll find Jesus on the other side of that line. It doesn't have to be this way. Our call is to question whether we will find our ultimate security in building ever more walls, whether psychological or physical. And perhaps the best lens to look through are the words we heard read from the letter of Paul to those in Corinth. It's no accident that both these texts are assigned readings for today. The reading, love, is mostly heard at weddings, and I can see why. If you can't talk about extravagant love at a wedding, when can you? They're useful words for those days when perhaps through clenched teeth a spouse says, I promised on our wedding day I would love you and I will keep that promise today even though I don't feel like it right now. But those words weren't written for weddings. They were written for all of us, all relationships. They're a model for how to live together when the going gets tough. They are our manifesto for living. These words apply to how we treat others, not just those we love and choose to love, but those we find most difficult to like, let alone love. And when so much of our national life seems gridlocked, it's good to keep a firm hold on the tenets we are to live by. They transcend party politics and national identity, neither of which should claim our primary identity in the first place. And the type of love described here can only be lived out when we understand the message that Jesus brought to his home crowd, the message they rejected, the message that none of us are deserving of God's extravagant love showered out on us. Here's what this type of love looks like as expressed in the message. Love never gives up. Love cares more for others than for self. Love doesn't want what it doesn't have. Love doesn't strut. Love doesn't have a swelled head. doesn't force itself on others, isn't always me first, doesn't fly off the handle, doesn't keep score of the sins of others, doesn't revel when others grovel, takes pleasure in the flowering of truth, puts up with anything, trusts God always, always looks for the best, never looks back, but keeps going to the end. You know it when you see it. Yet so often, we settle for living in its absence. One question has always puzzled me about this story. How did Jesus manage to walk through an angry mob of people and go on his way? One man against all those people. Isn't it true that some crowds, some people, can get so enraged, so caught up, so hypnotized by their own way of thinking that truth, light, and love are able to leave so swiftly and quietly they don't even notice? It doesn't have to be this way. Truth, light, and love, will we make them welcome even when God's words are challenging and hard for us to hear? This is how we build a house where love can dwell, as we sang in our first hymn. This is how deep healing can happen, when we can be freed from our own demons. That's what the crowd rejected when they rejected Jesus. And Jesus went on his way to heal elsewhere. Amen.